Welcome to the Primordial Soup Pot. My name is Aaron.
And I'm Rustin.
Every 2 weeks, Russ and I get together to discuss topics in the field of ecology, natural history, and evolution. And this week, we're going to be discussing weird diets / niches.
Yeah. I could tell you've been really, really excited about this one.
I found something so bizarre. There's nothing quite like it.
All right. Well, then I'm not going to hold you up anymore, man. Let's get right into it.
Okay. So a bit of a lead up, as I often like to do.
Yeah, me too. Who doesn't love a lead up?
Often in movies or video games, there's a common trope about a single person going up against the odds to bring down some sort of unstoppable force or adversary, and they usually just rely on their own wits or their willpower. For example, John Wick is fueled by vengeance, takes on the mafia after his dog is killed. Arnold Schwarzenegger going up against the Predator with sticks and mud. One of my personal favorites is the Doom Slayer from the Doom video game series, who fights off hordes of demons with his sawed-off shotgun. And I believe it used to be canon that the sole reason he can fight them off was that he was simply too angry to die. I think they changed it. He's like a demigod now.
Like, he makes it to the pearly gates, and there's just like a sign out front that says you must be less than this angry to enter, and he's like, ah, shucks. I gotta go back to living.
He goes to hell. He goes to hell, and he's happy with it. He just keeps killing demons. That's the lore.
Oh, okay. Well, you could probably tell I've never played Doom before, so.
Oh, it's an old game. There's newer ones. I played the newer one. Anyways, I found one animal that perfectly embodies this trait, that defies the odds and turns the food chain on its head. The animal that is too angry to die. Okay, so these are the Epomis beetles, a.k.a. the frog-eating beetles.
What?
Yeah, you heard that name correctly. This isn't a circus sideshow where I say man eating chicken and it's just a guy eating some chicken. No, these beetles eat frogs.
Whoa. I have never heard of these before.
Oh, they're weird. So for my bit, I'll start off with how these beetles hunt, and then I'll try and go deeper into how this even evolved, because that's an interesting conversation in and of itself.
Okay.
So for starters, there are several species of these beetles, and they're all within a subgenus known as Epomis. I'm just going to call them the Epomis beetles or the frog-eating beetles. There is about 20 or so species. These beetles are in the carabid family. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They're found all across the world.
What features are specific to this family?
Oh, great question. So they're all predators, and they're fairly fast and armored beetles. What's unique about them is the larvae are also predators, and they're actually fairly quick for being a larva. Usually, like a grub or a caterpillar, they don't move too quick. But these guys are fairly fast.
Okay.
Of course, when they get larger, they're armored. They get to roughly an inch in size, depending on the species, and many of them have iridescent shells that can come in brown, green, or red. So they're somewhat colorful looking, too.
Okay.
Like I said, the larvae are predators, and in most species, they feed on a variety of grubs, worms, and insects. And the adults do the same as well. Sometimes they will specialize in a specific group of invertebrates. There are some beetles that feed on caterpillars, and they're known as caterpillar hunters. And there's some that actually have elongated necks that allows them to reach inside the shells of snails, and they specialize on snails. Reach right into the shell.
Whoa. That's got to be kind of difficult, though, right? Like, don't snails have, like, a little protective coating that they put over the shell when they retract?
So some snails do, but some don't, and I wonder why they don't, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, if some do, why not all of them? Maybe that's a good question for another day, I guess. Anyways, the frog-eating beetles are not nearly as common. Like I said, there's about 20 or so species in this subgenus, and only two are really well studied. These would be the ones found in kind of Eastern Europe and the Middle East. The rest are all from the tropical regions of Africa, and there's not much information on them. So, let's walk through the life cycle. This may surprise you, the larvae are actually the main predator of the frogs, not the adults. So they're typically found near wetland streams or bogs. They're found in the same places you would find amphibians.
Right, that makes sense if they eat frogs, yeah.
They're smaller than the adults, and they top out at about 3/4 inch or 2 centimeters, kind of brown and yellow with various stripes or patterns, and they have a little bit of armor on their back. So not super squishy, but they're still kind of squishy. They possess a pair of large double-hooked jaws, so these are nasty bite on them. And they feed almost exclusively on amphibians. And you're probably thinking they just target really small amphibians like tadpoles, like, or little frogs that just got their legs.
Yeah, little tree frogs maybe?
No, they go for frogs that are several times their size. They target amphibians specifically that are big enough to eat them.
So we just have like some black swallower type beetles out here?
Pretty much. So the black swallower will eat whatever it can. These beetles specifically go for frogs that are bigger than them.
But why frogs?
Oh, so they can also hunt toads or salamanders as well.
Okay.
So amphibians.
But why amphibians then?
So that's a great question, and I will kind of get to that in the later portion of this.
Oh, okay.
Of the all why. Right. The whys are all very much up in the air.
In standard Rustin fashion, I'm jumping the gun a little bit here. Keep going.
Yeah, just a wee bit. A note with amphibians, like I said, frogs, toads, salamanders, newts, etc. They're kind of designed to eat bugs. They are so cued to movement that they will lunge out at anything they can fit in their mouth. Sometimes this is just a piece of dirt. Maybe it's another frog, or maybe it's something really bad like a wasp. If they see a little bit of movement, they're going to try it out. They're so fine-tuned towards this that many frogs can regurgitate part of their stomach and scrape off anything that they can't digest. So it is literally easier for them to eat first and ask questions later. They'd rather just eat the bug, hope it's good, and if it's not, then they'll spew it out, and they're okay with that.
Kind of sounds like me at Chipotle. I'm just going to eat whatever I think is edible and then ask questions later.
If you see him running into the back room, you know he did not like it.
You know, I chose poorly.
He chose poorly. Wrong chalice. Anyway, so the frog-eating beetles exploit this. The larvae, which, again, are small enough to be eaten, will actually wave their antennas and mandibles to attract the frog to it. So they are intentionally kind of doing a little dance to lure a frog over. The frog then, as frogs do, shoot out its tongue and grabs the larva. The larva is actually quick enough to flip around in that process and bite the frog on the bottom of its mouth and latch on.
Whoa.
Sorry, not the bottom of its mouth, around its throat. So it's not latching on inside the mouth. It kind of flips around. It bites like where its chin would be.
So these are like acrobat ninja type beetle larvae.
So they don't really move that much except when this happens, and then they do this like super quick 180. The way I like to think of it is they're kind of making themselves into both a lure and a hook for the frog.
So they're just like a gotcha lure then, basically. Like a little plug being dragged through the water.
Yeah, I guess so. This is like a sentient fishing lure. Closest thing we got.
It really is, yeah.
So once the larva has latched onto the bottom, they kind of work their way down a little bit to the frog's throat, and they start eating. It'll first drain the blood and fluids of the frog, and then, depending on how big it is, it'll start to eat the flesh until nothing but skin and bones remain. Sometimes the frog can shake off the larva and survive the ordeal, but these guys are pretty effective at what they do.
Ooh. Well, that sounds like a really terrible way to die.
Here's the first interesting bit. Oh, all of it's interesting. Here's a interesting bit. The larvae, depending on how old they are, they start off as an external parasite. And depending on how far it can go, they can be a full-blown predator. So one study found that the smaller larvae, so like the first instar, are parasites. And they don't kill the frog. They just drain enough of the bodily fluids, like they feed on the blood, and then they let go. They go about their business. The frog probably wants nothing to do with them anymore at that point, and it goes on its way also.
Yeah, yeah.
As they get bigger, they focus more on feeding on the actual tissue, like the muscle and the guts, and then they start to just eat the frog.
Wild.
Yeah, it's really cool. So they start off as a parasite, and then they become a full predator.
Whoa.
And in the rare chance the frog does manage to actually eat one of these, they've been documented surviving up to 2 hours in the frog's digestive tract, and the frog regurgitated them in a pile of blood.
So they tried to eat the frog from the inside out?
I'm pretty sure they were eating the frog from the inside out. Obviously, the researchers couldn't tell what was going on in there. And I believe their first thought was, man, that's a expensive grub to lose. And then 2 hours later, it comes up in a pile of blood. They theorized that it just kept biting the frog from the inside and caused internal bleeding until it yacked it up.
Oh my God. That's crazy.
So they are perfectly designed to eat frogs. The larger they get, the more frogs they'll eat until eventually they pupate into adults. And the adults eat frogs too.
Well, yeah.
This is all about just taking the fight to the amphibians, let me tell you. So the adults are generalists, and they can feed on other invertebrates. So, you know, they can feed on various worms, other insects. I think they could feed on carrion as well. They'll eat what they can get. But they will still feed on smaller frogs. So usually the adults will actually go for frogs that are about the same size as them. They don't do the same sort of lure thing. No, they kind of do it worse because the adults are a lot faster, larger, more armored. They can't utilize the fishing lure strategy. So what they do is they chase down a smaller frog, jump on its back, and start eating it right away. And they seem to have a way to paralyze the frog. It is not known if there's any venom in this species. And one theory is that they know to target a specific muscle or nerve bundle that disables the frog's hind limbs and it can't hop away. Okay. And then they just eat the frog alive, starting with the back.
Interesting. That's really, really cool. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, sometimes the habits of youth just don't die, you know?
Yeah. I did mention there's no known venom. One of the researchers did say, this is like in an interview, that he was bit by one of them and his finger felt a little numb. But, you know, they couldn't really attribute that to a venom. Could have just, you know, hit a pressure point. So jury's still out on that one.
Right. And also, was that part of the experiment totally above board?
Like the biting the finger?
Yeah, like was that actually like just an incidental part of experimentation, or was he just kind of like messing around with the beetles a little bit too much and got bit because of it?
I like to think he was trying to catch a runner that was getting away, and you know, he was going after it with like a paper cup.
Yeah, but if he's going after it with a paper cup, why'd he get bit on the finger?
He missed. I don't know. It didn't say how it came about. Maybe he was mishandling one of the beetles.
Yeah. Carrying out a dare or something like that.
Yeah, maybe. So don't get me wrong. I love frogs. They're some of my favorite animals. But this is simply, it's too fascinating to not be impressed by. I can't even be mad at the beetles. I respect the strategy.
Honestly.
Respect the grit.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, I love birds, but yeah, if a fish found a way to eat an osprey, I would be impressed by that too. Like,
yeah, you can't even be mad.
Right. I'm not even mad. That's amazing.
So most of this research comes from two studies originally published in the 2010s by Dr. Wizen and Dr. Gasseth. And Dr. Wizen even said that he loves frogs and he's had them as pets in the past. But the beetles were just so groundbreaking that they needed to be studied.
I could totally see why.
So now I want to transition to the, you know, the theories, the driving theories behind this all. The why. So why do 20-some species of beetles do this? You know, start off as small ectoparasites, transition to obligatory amphibian predators, and then generalist predators, they're still adapted to taking out amphibians. Why do they do this when most of the others don't? So this is something known as predator-prey reversal. It is somewhat rare, and the beetles are an extreme case of it. So predator-prey reversal is exactly how it sounds. It's when the food chain kind of gets flipped a little bit, where the prey species will be going after the predator. Now, there's kind of a range of examples of this. So one example would be maybe the prey species is simply too large to be eaten by the predator anymore. So let's say a coyote can go after a baby deer. A full-grown buck, it's probably not going to go after that. It's a bit too big for it.
Right, right.
Oh, no. Another example, let's say we have a largemouth bass that will feed on sunfish. Well, those sunfish will probably also eat baby largemouth bass. So that's another example of a reversal where they're both kind of eating each other at different life stages.
True, but to be fair, I think pretty much anything would feed on baby largemouth bass. I think largemouth bass would feed on baby largemouth bass, for that matter.
That they would. So the whole predator-prey reversal thing, it gets a little into gray areas, especially with fish, because most fish will eat whatever smaller fish they can, and those smaller fish could definitely grow up to be predators of them.
Yeah, totally. Totally. The whole phenomenon kind of reminds me of that scene in Futurama where Zoidberg suddenly becomes ginormous. Mr. Chase Bank, deny my bank loan, will you? And then he destroys the whole building.
Yeah, more or less the same thing. So the beetles are an extreme case where the prey species goes fully on the offensive against their former predators. The best example I could find of this is there were two different islands with lobsters and whelks, which is a carnivorous snail. And on one island, the lobsters dominated the whelks and they would eat them. And on the other island, it was the opposite. And I believe there were some environmental factors. There was a reason why these two islands in the same ocean had these two different ecosystems dominated by two different animals that will eat each other. But that was really the only comparative case I could find.
Okay, so it's also kind of like if the French suddenly invaded Nazi Germany.
Exactly, if we're going off all the French themes, yeah. So in this case, we got to look at what sets the larva apart from other larvae in this family. So all the carabid beetles are carnivores, like I mentioned. But most of the larvae are active predators that chase down their prey, and they're fairly quick. Well, these larvae are eaten by frogs pretty frequently. In fact, many of the frogs that are eaten by the Epomis beetles will eat closely related species. You can find them in their fecal matter. The Epomis beetles are the outsiders, where they're not active predators, they're ambush predators, and they actually lure in the frogs and attack them. So one theory is that this behavior may have evolved from a strategy to actually avoid predation on these frogs. So they remain still to avoid being detected, and then if they are attacked by the frog, they quickly try and bite onto it so it can't swallow them, kind of latch on.
So it could have originally evolved as some kind of defense mechanism?
Exactly.
Gotcha, gotcha. Okay.
You know how we said they'll eat them from the inside? That's, well, maybe they bite even when they're swallowed by the frog in a desperate attempt to kind of work their way out.
Well, I mean, that's totally understandable. If I was swallowed whole by something, I would try to do anything to get out of there. I mean, that's a, you got nothing to lose at that point. Do whatever you can.
Yeah. It's kind of odd that not all the bugs do this, but they seem to find a way to perfect it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
This strategy of avoiding predation could have eventually evolved into a way of becoming a predator of your former predator. So just like the movie Predator, the hunter becomes the hunted.
It's the ultimate Uno reverse card.
Exactly. So to put it in a different perspective of how bizarre this is, imagine we have a porcupine and a coyote, and the porcupine has evolved quills to deal with the coyote feeding on them. Now imagine this porcupine goes the extra mile and starts using the quills to impale the coyotes and turn them into a shish kebab. This is an exaggeration, but it's essentially the same premise.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a totally apt metaphor.
To put it in more human perspective, imagine you have airbags in a car, and of course they're designed to protect you from collisions. Let's say you get your car converted so the airbags actually explode outwards. Instead of protecting you, they shoot out of your bumper to damage the car that hit you even more. That's kind of like what the Beatles are doing.
Hey, sometimes the best defense is a good offense.
Exactly. No one even wants to hit you. They know the consequences. Right. So regardless, however the Beatles have evolved to feed on frogs, they're doing a good job of it. They've been documented feeding on, like I said, many amphibians, including frogs, toads, and salamanders, upwards of, I believe, 20 to 30 different species, just what's been documented. With this strategy, it sounds like they could kind of feed on any amphibian, really.
Yeah, and based on how little that we still have to discover about arthropods and specifically beetles, there could be twice that number of species, right?
Oh, there could be a lot more. I mean, there could be so many more out there, especially because the majority of the species comes from regions that aren't necessarily easy to study.
Right, right.
So as of now, there doesn't seem to be any counter to this on the frog's end. Again, this is kind of an arms race, and that the Beatles are winning this one.
They definitely have the... I think that's mainly because of the element of surprise, though. Like, as a frog, there's no way you see this coming, right?
I guess not. Well, I mean, some live to tell the tale. But, yeah, you like I said, amphibians, they kind of just eat whatever they see. You know, they see a little movement, they go at it. If you have a pet frog, it's probably tried to eat dirt at one point or another.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
So one study found that the beetles had a success rate of 98%.
98?
So pretty good. Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, this was in captivity, so, you know, in the wild, there's other factors at play. But still, that's pretty significant.
Okay, but still, 98, that's an A+. They're still probably averaging at least a B in the wild.
Oh, yeah. No, they're doing great. I know some people will probably think, like, oh, these beetles are going to pose a huge threat to amphibian populations worldwide. No.
Yeah, probably not. There just aren't a lot of them, right?
There's not many of them, but also they are specialists on amphibians. They need amphibians to live. So it's not in their best interest to exterminate them all. In fact, yeah. As amphibian populations are declining worldwide, these beetles probably are too.
Okay, yeah, I could see that.
As you often see with predators that specialize on a single prey species, when the prey goes down, so do they.
Yeah, and it's a theme we've talked about repeatedly on this podcast, that when extreme changes happen to an environment, the species that are most affected are the specialists, and the generalists tend to take over from there.
Yeah, so these beetles could definitely take a hard hit whenever there's a population collapse or really any environmental upset. As of now, they seem to be doing fine. There's still much we have to learn about them, how many species there are, their full range. One more thing that I thought was worth noting is that I mentioned the young larva, the first instars, don't typically kill their prey. They are parasites, but they won't kill them. And the adult beetles are generalists that aren't obligated frog eaters. They can eat other food. They have a lot of different options to work with. And this kind of seems like a balance to prevent overpredation or competition between the adults and the juveniles. Because something you'll find with a lot of insects, or a lot of animals in general, is you don't want the adults and the juveniles to eat the same food, because then they're going to compete over it. Right. And that's not good for a species. So often you'll find with insects, well, just think caterpillars and butterflies, they're eating two very different things. With the butterflies going after nectar, and the caterpillars going after the plants themselves.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay.
And that is my piece.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay, now I totally understand why you were so hyped about this episode.
It's weird.
Yeah, it's weird, but so cool. So I would never have guessed that that was a niche that a beetle occupied somewhere.
Oh, there's a lot of beetles out there. So, I mean, odds are one of them had to do it. But again, this is, I don't think there's any animal quite like these group of beetles.
Right.
Doing the same thing.
Yeah, but I didn't think it would be so dramatic, nor so effective, really.
Yeah. Like I said, 98% of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, they got a remarkable success rate, really. My turn now?
Yep. What do you got for me?
All right. So, I'm also going to give you a little bit of setup here. Imagine you're a very large fish on a coral reef. Overall, life is all right. You live among lots of prey. You generally just coast around, and it's very colorful. It's a nice place to live. Sure, you have to know what prey is poisonous, and there is an abnormal amount of stinging things, but in general, it's a good place to live.
Yeah, life is good.
Right. The main problem that you have is that these coral reefs have a lot of parasites. You don't have opposable thumbs to remove them. So if they latch on, they tend to stay there. They're sticking around for a bit. How do you get rid of these highly annoying and sometimes really harmful freeloaders? Well, lucky for you, the reefs have a whole suite of fish that remove parasites for you. Now, in general, this is actually a relatively common practice throughout the oceans. Like, I can kind of see the look on your face, and you're thinking this is not that unique of a niche, but just stick with me for a second here.
Okay.
Because I'm going to be focusing on one specific genus that does have some really unique aspects and some really unique niches. That genus is Labrades. This particular genus is comprised of fish that are less than a foot long and can be a variety of different colors. They generally have two stripes that run along the sides of their body. You can find this particular group of fish on reefs around the Indo-Pacific, so anywhere from Indonesia, the South Pacific, all the way up to Hawaii. And they feed, as I just mentioned, by feeding upon the parasites of larger fish. Now, one thing that is really cool about this particular genus is that they have this whole pre-cleaning interaction with the client fish. The client fish being the fish that is having the parasites removed. So when a large client approaches the cleaner...
I like the term client fish.
I know.
Used in a scientific sense.
I do too. And it's totally scientific. I saw this term over and over in very technical, peer-reviewed scientific papers as I was researching this episode.
It works. I can't think of anything better.
Yeah, it's great, but it's also just kind of a really cool term. But anyway, so the client fish approaches the cleaner, and they don't always let the cleaners immediately do their thing. There's a little bit of suspicion there because there's a lot of trust involved for the clients, right? They're letting the cleaners into every little nook and cranny of their body. It's a bit like going to the dentist, but for your entire body, right? You go to the dentist and
you want them to buy you a drink first.
Right, sure. But seriously though, you go to the dentist and they just clean your teeth and they get all the gunk out of the little nooks and crannies, and that's a bit invasive, but very important. But for these fish, it's happening everywhere, right? You know, we as people really want to trust our dentist, and so it makes a lot of sense that these client fish really want to trust their cleaners. Furthermore, though, there's a lot of trust on the part of the cleaners because these clients are large predatory fish. They could get eaten if things go wrong. So, right? They could die. This is really risky for them. In less dramatic cases, though, the client could simply just swim away and leave before the cleaning is done, right? And for the cleaners, this is how they eat. So they could starve. They could not get a full meal, right? So there's a certain amount of distrust right off the bat for both parties. And so both individuals need to do something to establish that trust. Well, the Labrades overcome this by doing what is called a pre-cleaning dance, where they point their heads away from the client and brush their fins along the body of the larger fish. And we know that this has nothing to do with cleaning because their head's facing in the opposite direction. Right?
It's just a little tickle.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually what it is. And so this provides a kind of tactile sensation that actually relaxes the client, which puts them at ease, and it makes it less likely that they'll try to eat the cleaners or, you know, panic if the cleaners pinch them while removing the parasites. Because, you know,
I actually do something similar in job interviews. I just I give them a little tickle, you know? You show them I'm a fun guy.
You just lean across the desk and are just like, have you met the tickle monster before?
God, that's a very Michael Scott thing to do.
It really is. And you know what? Dwight Schrute would totally go for it. Anyway, but in all seriousness, this is really effective because it causes the clients to stick around longer and leads to a more mutually beneficial cleaning session. So it's very important, actually. Not only is this interaction beneficial mutually, but there's also serious benefits for the overall health of the coral reef, because it's been shown that when you remove the cleaners from a reef, the population of large fish decreases, as does the average size of those fish. Additionally, it's less likely that fish will move to a reef that doesn't have any cleaners on it, because those large fish have important ecological roles, since many of them are apex predators, and then modulate the populations of almost everything else on the reef. Really, the cleaners help maintain the entire ecological structure of the reef by servicing these large predators. They keep the large predators intact at the top of the reef. By extension, the cleaners have this really, really important ecological role and provide serious benefits. After that bit, you probably think that the cleaners and clients have this perfect relationship, right? Like, they're ecologically beneficial. It's a very mutually beneficial interaction. Everything's all rosy, right? Yeah?
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Well, no. No, it is not. And this is where I get to the really interesting bit. And the bit about unique niches. Because it turns out that Laborides cleaner fish sometimes prefer to feed not on the parasites, but instead upon the mucous membranes of their client fish. Now, the mucous membrane is the outer coating of a fish that helps protect them from their environment. It keeps them safe from a lot of pathogens that are floating around in the water and helps prevent them from getting sick.
And apparently it tastes good.
And apparently it is delicious. The cleaners really like to eat it. And this is a serious problem for the clients because that membrane helps protect them from their environment, right? If they don't have it, they're very vulnerable.
So not only are they eating this membrane when they're supposed to be removing parasites, but removing that membrane might actually make them more prone to pathogens and parasites.
Yes, exactly. They're making things far worse by doing this. What's interesting, though, is that if the cleaners are witnessed feeding on these mucous membranes, the clients catch on really quickly, and they stay away from those particular cleaners, right? So on these reefs, the cleaners kind of occupy a little section of coral. They have their own little home, and the clients know that they go over there to get cleaned, and they just kind of go over there, sit there, and cleaners will, like, you know, come up and do their thing. Well, if the cleaners are feeding on the membranes, the clients just stop going over there, right? Mm-hmm. So the cleaners have to pay attention to what other individuals are in the vicinity, because if they're witnessed eating the membrane of another fish and the parasites on that fish, they could be dealing with some really, really hellish Yelp reviews. And so it has been scientifically proven that the Laborides cleaner fish are far less likely to feed on the membranes of their clients when there are witnesses. So if there's a second fish there, they'll pretty much just stick to the parasites and do their job like they should, really. And they're not going to cheat. But if there's only one fish there, who the hell knows? They might eat whatever they'd like to eat. So if you're a client, it's best that you go to the cleaners with a friend.
So they really want to avoid that malpractice suit.
Exactly. Exactly. They don't want any eyewitnesses to their tomfoolery.
They probably don't even have a license. You know, they probably snagged it online from the University of American Samoa.
Oh, yeah. Definitely not above board. Definitely not. It gets even crazier because the other reason you want to go with a friend if you're a client fish is that not all the cleaner fish are what they seem. There is a species of fish called the saber-toothed blenny, which looks nearly identical to a Laborides cleaner fish, but they are in fact the precise opposite. Because instead of taking parasites off of a larger fish, they are parasites themselves. They feed by sucking the blood of larger fish. So clients come up to what they think is a cleaner, but instead of having their parasite problem solved, it gets so much worse. Right? Because now they have this little fish that's sucking their blood and all these parasites. So it's like calling a contractor to fix a hole in your wall, and then when the truck pulls up to your house, the Kool-Aid man steps out.
The break through the walls.
Yes, exactly. You're going to have to call like three contractors after this whole thing is done.
My first thought is that he was going to like get stains on the floor that you couldn't get out.
No.
So we started off with, we have like kind of shady, a dentist, you know, like they might try and bill you a little extra. They don't know exactly what they're doing, but you bring a parent in with you and they straighten up their act. And then the other group is just going to put you under and take your kidney.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, or just straight up remove your teeth for the gold that's in there. Like, whatever. It's totally, totally, yeah, it's really sketchy. Just totally going to screw you over. So, all this is to say, it's really easy to see why the client fish are kind of apprehensive about these cleaning services. Because not all these, you know, establishments are perfectly legitimate. And some of them are really, really harmful. So, not only do the cleaners sometimes eat their protective lair, but you also have to worry about these crazy incognito vampire fish that just exacerbate the whole problem. And really just do nothing to fix your original issue. However, it cannot be denied that both the cleaner fish and the saber-toothed blenny occupy these really, really unique niches in their reef communities. So, that's my piece.
Yeah, really cool.
Those are the Labroides and their imitation vampire blennies.
That's super cool. When you're just going with the cleaning thing, I thought, I've seen Finding Nemo. I've seen this one before.
Right.
But, yeah, I liked all the, yeah, a lot of different aspects to it they didn't know about.
Jack, I said no cleaning. I shall resist. But, yeah, no. So, I agree. Just doing the cleaner fish would have kind of been a cop-out. Like, that's kind of like a surface-level, unique niche that a lot of people think about. But then I found out about the saber-toothed blennies, and I was like, all right, now I got to talk about these guys. People have to know about these saber-toothed blennies because they're like, you know, thieves in disguise as dentists.
One day you might find yourself scuba diving in the Bahamas, and you got something sucked onto you, and then you need to know.
People got to be prepared, and these client fish really got to know about these really, really shady people. Shady blennies, I should say.
At some point, like, I don't know, maybe I just get desperate and try scraping up against a rock.
Honestly, yeah. That's only so effective, right? Because a lot of these parasites will sometimes get, like, they'll sometimes get attached, like, in their gills or even in their mouth. And so that's where you really need the cleaners, because the cleaners can get into all those little nooks and crannies and get all the parasites out. A lot of us, people might have seen the videos of the cleaner shrimp that actually go into the mouth of, a moray eel. Which is the last place you'd ever want to go if you're a highly edible prey. But the shrimp just go in there with like no questions asked. And yeah, they remove the parasites because the morays can't do it for themselves. It is a legitimately mutually beneficial reaction or interaction. But yeah, there's a whole lot of cheating and other shenanigans that are going on here. Those shenanigans create some really unique niches.
That they do. It makes me wonder. So I know you said that the client fish will kind of, you know, they'll come to this spot. So I'm guessing they have their own territories, like their own designated shops.
The cleaners?
Set up.
Yes.
Yeah. I wonder if they ever like have fish defending them or maybe even trying to corral them for their own personal use.
What do you mean? Like fish that try to recruit specific cleaners or?
So my first thought was maybe there's like a large predator fish and he won't allow other fish to access a cleaner.
Oh, to my knowledge, that doesn't really happen because these visits from client fish are pretty occasional. I keep using the dentist metaphor, but imagine how often you go to the dentist. You know, you go once a year probably. So imagine like one dude just sitting outside of a dentist's office with a double barrel shotgun, like trying to keeping everyone away from that dentist's office.
I mean, maybe his teeth are just terrible.
Right, but even then, if they're that bad, you don't need a dentist, man. You need an orthodontist. Get your professionals right. But second, like, you probably need to go to the dentist once a year. Are you really going to put in that much effort?
He's a good dentist.
To make sure you're the dentist's only client when you only need the dentist like once a year.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, I'm not saying the dentists aren't important, and you totally need those services, but you're not going to put in that much effort to make sure that, you know, you're the exclusive customer, you know?
Yeah.
And that's also not good for the cleaners either, right? Because the cleaners need to eat, and I'm sorry, one fish just isn't growing that many parasites. It's also not good in it. And if you think about it, right, the cleaners, like I said, will also feed on the membranes. So if there's this one predatory fish that's like scaring away all the other clients, the cleaners aren't going to have anything to eat aside from the membrane of that one client fish. You really only want to be around the cleaner for so long. And you want to be there with a friend, too. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of mind games that are going on here.
Yeah, definitely. Lots of layers to it.
For sure. For sure. And one very important membrane.
Oh, yeah.
But in any case, that's my piece.
Did you have anything in mind for the next episode? I kind of spearheaded this one. I don't really have anything else. Kind of made our way through the list of mine.
Yeah, me too, honestly. I don't really have anything on deck.
I have it. Yeah, I kind of worked through.
I really did, yeah.
I thought you would have something. I picked this one. We do a bug episode.
Oh, I was just going to say, if we're going to do a bug episode, you got to toss that back my way with a bird episode.
We've already done a bird episode.
Another bird episode.
I'm picking animal groups we haven't done before.
Okay, all right.
That's why I just said bug because there's a lot of bugs.
That's true. All right, yeah. I'll do a bug episode.
Okay, bug episode it is.
But with that decided, do you want to take us out?
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving us a like and review on your podcast app of choice. And if you have a suggestion for a future episode, you can reach us at SoupPotPodcast on X or theprimordialsouppot@gmail.com.
Sounds good. And until next time, I'm Rustin.
And I'm Aaron.
See ya.